Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is Lauren Huff, author of Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing, a knockout debut essay collection out now from Vintage Books. That's Huff, H-O-U-G-H, who you might recognize from Twitter, which she rules, or perhaps you caught her widely read essay in the Huffington Post in 2018, I Was a Cable Guy, I Saw the Worst of America, in which she drew back the curtain on what it was like to do that job as a woman for 10 years, and it was packed with on-the-job stories so good they seemed almost unbelievable. Extraordinary might be a better word, which is one of the first words Roxane Gay chose to describe Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. Let me read you part of her blurb for Huff's book. Quote, Lauren Huff's extraordinary essay collection, Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing, is as powerful as it is poignant. So many moments in these exceptionally crafted essays brought me to tears, and before long I would find myself laughing as Huff wielded her razor-sharp wit. This is a memoir and essays about so many things. Growing up in an abusive cult, coming of age as a lesbian in the military, forced out by homophobia, living on the margins as a working-class woman, and what it's like to grow into the person you are meant to be. Huff's writing will break your heart. End quote. Yes, growing up in an abusive cult, coming of age as a lesbian in the military, living on the margins as a working-class woman, you will find all this and more in the pages of Huff's remarkable debut. Kirkus calls it a thoughtful book that, quote, explores the shaping power of the past and also raises provocative questions about what really constitutes a cult, end quote. Oh, and it was recently announced that Kate Blanchett reads the Cable Guy essay in the audiobook, which she and Huff take turns narrating. What? That's cool. After this brief indie interview, I'll be talking with Lauren Huff, author of Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing, out now from Vintage Books.
This message is brought to you by Alana Horwich, author of Meal and a Spiel. Author and LA-based chef and cooking teacher, Alana Horwich wants you to learn how to be a badass in the kitchen. Instead of stressing about homemade food, learn to be an intuitive cook and whip up easy and delicious dishes that make you want to roll on the floor shouting mama. Drawing inspiration from years in Italy, Horwich shares humorous, heartfelt stories and explains the fundamentals of Italian cooking in a super approachable way that builds confidence and gets readers inspired to live la dolce vita, no matter what cooking level you're currently at. This gorgeous, thick denim-covered book will look fabulous on your coffee table and entertain you immensely. Meal and a Spiel is friendly for all diets and healthy without compromising flavor. With gluten-free, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, low-sugar recipes, you'll find everything from burrata crostini with honeyed leeks to a to-die-for no-noodle lasagna to flourless chocolate blender cakes with, yes, olive oil. Consider this a fabulous chic hostess gift. Meal and a Spiel was featured by Hallmark Home and Family, Real Simple, BuzzFeed, CNN, Reader's Digest, and more. Get your hard copy of Meal and a Spiel on Amazon to become a kitchen badass now. This message is brought to you by Bob Finer, author of the children's picture book, The Tree That Ate Everything. Jake and Austin are twins, and they are celebrating their birthday with a trip to the park to play with their new toys. There, they meet a lively and whimsical tree who also happens to be celebrating her birthday. The boys are twins, but Jake has Down syndrome and Austin does not. Based on author Bob Finer's two sons, the story provides a, quote, gentle, between-the-lines theme of love and acceptance that resonates throughout, end quote. Illustrated by Gina Hagen, the full-page watercolor images are sunny and tender. Kirkus called it, quote, a tale with an appealing message of inclusion, end quote. Bob was the 2015 recipient of the Disability Matters National Disability Champion Award, and a portion of all proceeds benefit the Down syndrome community. You can find The Tree That Ate Everything in Kindle and paperback on Amazon and at the website finerbook.com.
Welcome, Lauren, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you wrote an essay that was published in December 2018 in the Huffington Post, and the headline was, "I was a cable guy, I saw the worst of America." And they decked it, "A glimpse of the suburban grotesque featuring Russian mobsters, Fox News rage addicts, a caged man in a sex dungeon, and Dick Cheney." After 2020, I personally am retiring viral when it comes to describing a story, but let's just say it was widely read. What inspired you to write about that experience?
I wish I had a better story for why I wrote that. I was in a creative writing class and I was procrastinating and I was stoned as shit and got on Twitter and I was like, "Hey, you guys want to hear some dumb cable guy stories?" And one of my friends who worked for fucking Lesbian Network, being what it is, Jen Bendery, who works for the HuffPost, read it, the thread, and was like, "Hey, my editor wants to talk to you." So I wrote a story. Didn't really know what I wanted to write about, but I was sitting out in front of the bar where I worked, checking IDs, and I had to pee really bad. And I was like, that is what I remember being a cable guy, is I constantly had to pee. So.
And things just unspooled from there.
Yep.
Okay, so it's a tremendous success, as we said, widely read. Did things change for you after its publication?
Yes and no. Kind of everything changed and nothing changed. I was still working at the bar, but I was talking to editors and producers and, "Hey, hold on, dude, can I see your ID?" And people were coming in to talk to me, which was always kind of a hostage situation because I'm at work. And so I can't leave, but they're standing in front of me telling me their life story, or it was a little bit bizarre, to say the least. But yeah, I mean, nothing else changed. I was still failing out of creative writing and still working at a bar for a long time until I sold the book and finally was able to quit that. So I had time to write it.
Hmm. There is an essay in this collection called Cable Guy. Is it reprinted or revised version of that?
It's revised. I didn't want to get into, for the Huffington Post, I didn't want to get into much of the backstory at all of like who I was and why I react the way I do to some things. Right. So I put a lot of stuff back in.
So that kind of gets towards, can we flesh that out a little bit, like about the goal, the goals of the revision and Who you are.
Who I am.
Who are you?
I mean, it's kind of the problem with me writing anything is, in order to explain who I am and why I might react a little differently than someone else. We all do, though. But I mean, my backstory is I grew up in a cult. So, just knocking on someone's door as a cable guy was... I have the stupidest fucking triggers is the problem. I don't like spoons. I don't like knocking on doors. So I had to put that stuff back in. Not the spoons. That's really not an interesting story at all.
Well, we specialize in your least interesting story here at Fully Booked. So if you want to go for it, I'm here with bated breath. But if you want to move on, we could do that too.
We can totally move on. It's like the Kimmy Schmidt Velcro thing. It's just a dumb thing.
Right, right. I want to talk more about knocking on doors. It's interesting to me because my first job out of college was, it involved knocking on doors, and that's about all I want to say about it. But, like when you're approaching random houses, places you're sent to, you don't have control over really. I started thinking about that experience a lot, thinking about your experience that you present in this book. And I watched your TEDx talk, "A Lesbian Walks into a Bathroom, A Lesson on Code Switching." And you talk about the code switching as a cable tech and the different ways men and women approach doorways, the different ways men and women open doors, like both sides of the equation. If you're not in the privileged position, it's always a stressful moment.
It is. I think for anyone, I think the big thing with me being a cable guy is I spent my life knocking on doors and never really went inside. a house. I mean, I've been inside houses, but people don't generally invite you in to when you're the weird missionary trying to sell them literature.
Right.
But yeah, going into people's houses was, I'd finally been past the threshold, and people tend to keep their threshold a little bit tidy. And then you walk in and every hoarder is in the middle of cleaning up. The strange thing to me is just how mundane. I imagined people's lives being something a lot more interesting, but yeah, you can buy a sex swing, but you're just going to hang laundry on it.
Ain't that the truth?
That's what happens to all of the sex toys, is there are places to hang underpants to dry.
Oh my gosh. I wonder about the revision of self that, you know, that you would go through having a job like that. It's like you already just said, you know, like that you realized how mundane it actually is, you know, that experience of coming into people's homes. I mean, they are usually expecting you when you're a cable guy, but still, like, you don't have time to clean your whole entire hoarder house. So it is kind of interesting to see in sequence all these representations of the way people actually live in their homes.
But yeah, it was not what I expected. It was the fanciest house in Great Falls could have just one mattress on the floor in one room.
So obviously this collection is not called Cable Guy. It's called Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. It's interesting because it makes it kind of a Kristen Rupenian situation, like where her short story collection was called, like, You Know You Want This, Cat Person and Other Stories. But I think when they like released another version of it, I think they just cut it and they called it Cat Person and Other Stories. So it's like the secret, you know, in invisible ink subtitle of this to me is like Cable Guy and Other Stories. But I think Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing might be my favorite essay in the collection. Would you talk a little bit? Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing.
No, don't worry about the title. Like, the thing about the title is, here's some writing advice. Be careful what you name your essay when you send them into your editor, because I just needed a file name other than this goddamn thing that's not fucking working. So I just, and I think the line ended up getting cut in the essay, but I just titled it Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. And marketing went crazy. That's the perfect title for the book. What title are you guys talking about?
Oh, do you ever name other files though, like this fucking thing?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of files named this fucking thing one, this fucking thing two, this fucking thing revised.
Okay, so this time we're gonna keep that part of the tape in, you know, and shame on me. But like, Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. Would you talk a little bit about what that essay is about?
I don't remember. It's I anytime I read a story about a cult, I don't know why I went Canadian there, but I did. Anytime I read a story about cults and people describe my story as, and they're still in the reviews and whatever, escaped a cult. We didn't escape. We just walked out. there was no like cloak and dagger thing going on. We just left after dinner. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I was trying to say with that title that was not supposed to be a title is it's gathering the courage or the wherewithal to walk out and to stay out. It's a lot easier just to stay in a shitty relationship than it is to walk out of it. It's a whole lot easier to stay, no matter where it is, in a crappy cable job. So yeah, I was trying to tie some of those things together, I think. But the leaving the family wasn't the difficult part. It was reassimilating into society. It was figuring out who I was without it.
It's kind of blew my mind, this collection, because it really just kind of spun my thoughts about belonging to any group around a little bit. It's like, you know, you can belong to a cult, you can belong to a branch of the armed forces, you can belong to a country, you can be an American citizen. And it's like, you know, the belonging to the group, right, doesn't necessarily tell you who you are, but it's like a number of practices we engage in,
right? It's like there's a performative aspect to it, to citizenship or a membership in any other group. And like, you know, all these things that we do that make us the thing, like that make us the American or make us the, you know, airman or make us the lesbian, you know, like it's modes of engagement is what I want to, right?
Yeah, it is. It's easy. Became a baseball fan because it's easier to have a conversation when you're a fan of something. So, yes, it's more fun to watch the baseball game if you're rooting for a specific team. But, you know, my nephew was really into New England teams and grew up watching Tom Brady, and I sort of liked baseball because I like the sounds in the background. I write to baseball games a lot. I don't know why. The sounds are fucking great. I think they remind me of my grandma. She was a huge Cubs fan.
Really?
So, yeah, there was always a Cubs game on in the background. So, yeah, I became a Red Sox fan, and then it was easy to have a conversation with the guys. Instead of, you know, what'd you do that weekend? They would just ask me about the game and quote stats at me, and you just nod and play along, and there you go, conversation done.
Right. You know, it's a lingua franca, and, and it's a safety measure, oftentimes.
It is, and you don't have to explain where you're from. They just assume. You don't have to explain anything. They have something to talk about with you. So it's a little shortcut to having, I think, it's a shortcut to connection, but it's also just a shortcut to defining yourself.
Right.
You know, we all like to be things. I like to be Scots Irish because it explains why I'll hit you.
watch out.
don't fuck with me. We're rage addicts with short tempers and substance abuse problems. But yeah, we all like to have our thing. Italian Americans like to have their thing about why they're the best pasta cooks until they go to Italy.
And we like Parmesan cheese on everything.
Exactly.
We do. And we're proud of it.
It's part of our culture. It's part of whether you grew up in it or not. That's the thing that defines you.
This is, you know, tangential, but like you mentioned, you like the sound of the baseball game in the background. Not to go full James Lipton on you or anything like that, but what's your least favorite sound?
Oh, anything repetitive. I really hate repetitive sounds. The water dripping will drive me up the wall. Least favorite sound? You know... That song at the beginning of Orange is the New Black is probably my least favorite song.
Okay. I got two more for you that just came to me. What's your favorite adjective?
Fucking.
What's the number one cocktail? You're a former bartender. What's the number one cocktail someone can order that will make the bartender think they're an asshole?
Jaeger.
Thank you. this concludes Inside the Actor's Studio. Okay, so back to the essays. I mean, I want to ask you some version of the question, why do you write an essay? Or like, what are you looking to get out of it? Or, you know, like, how did your education help you hone them? Like, what is, you know, what are your thoughts on craft? All that kind of stuff that, you know, like, I'm supposed to ask an author, right? That's you.
Yeah, what fucking education? essays. I chose essays because... they seem kind of fun. You can take, my brain doesn't really work all that linearly. Is that a word? There's my education showing. But I can take all these different parts. It's kind of like the interview question. You go to a job interview and you have like these three stories. And if they ask about team building, you're going to pull that story out. And here's my team building story. But you know, if you're going back through your own life and trying to write an essay, you have, you know, all of this material and you could tell a lot of different stories through it, but it's linking those different things to kind of make your point. And it turned out I have a lot of opinions, bad or otherwise. And it was a great way to leave things out. It was a great way to put things in. They seemed fun. And then it's done. That essay is done. And you can move on to the next thing. You don't have to keep rehashing that same thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they just seemed fun.
Right.
You can fit a lot more interiority into there. It can go off on my little diatribes and back alleys. And yeah, sometimes those turn out to be the essay, and what I was talking about didn't matter at all.
Yeah, you mentioned leaving things, you know, putting things in, leaving things out. I mean, it's craft, it's art. And, you know, a lot of times with essayists, you know, you'll see in the very enthusiastic, like, you know, blurbs or reviews, you know, like an admiration of the essayist's vulnerability or like bravery at talking about this thing that the person was obviously struck by. Like, does that feel complimentary?
No, it feels... Honestly, it feels pretty fucking insulting.
Really?
Yeah. I don't
Let's
know
talk
why,
about
but it.
It
does.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why yet. I think it's because if you write a short story, if you write any sort of fiction, you'll do interviews about your craft and why you put that in and how mm-hmm. you wrote that sentence and the cadence of it and the word choice and...
Yeah.
You know, the length of your fucking sentences. If you write about something that happened to you, then you're being vulnerable.
Right.
Or brave. Or God help me, if I'm inspiring, I'll burn the book. that is my plan, is to inspire no one. but yeah, I don't see it as vulnerability.
Right.
I don't even see it as bravery. I see it as I had something to say, so I said it.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing is, you know, like I never hear David Sedaris, you know, called, you know, complimented for his bravery or his, you know, vulnerability, especially in the early essay collections. They're like, this is so funny. Wow. Wow, he really knows how to have an experience and make us laugh about it. Wow, like what talent, you know? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to be complimented for being funny. That's probably the one skill set I'm really proud of, because that developed. I developed that very carefully. I worked real fucking hard on making people laugh, but
Yeah,
and I don't want to get into the bravery of why I worked hard at making people laugh.
Totally.
I mean, obviously, it's a fucking defense mechanism, but you're not my therapist. Like, we don't really need to discuss why.
Well, this is the point in the interview where I compliment you on being very, very funny.
Thank you.
And also very, very, very funny on Twitter. Do you see Twitter as a workshop, or is it a thing apart for you as far as your writing goes?
I mean, I'd like to think it's a workshop, but mostly it's just a way to avoid writing. Sometimes I am trying to figure something out or figure out a way to tell something and just kind of seeing what catches, but you can't really tell, because who knows what'll catch on Twitter and who's looking at Twitter at the same time. Mm. It's a time waster, but it's also... I mean, I came up, like I said, I was working at a bar. I was going to community college, and I met people like Elizabeth McCracken, who kind of mentored me and showed me how to do this, and Sandra Newman, who's talked me off of every fucking ledge. That poor woman. She's the one who gets all the DMs when everything's falling apart. But yeah, and I don't know. I hear a lot of people shit talking writers as being jealous and, you know, vindictive and mean or whatever. They've been really generous with me. I had no connections, and because of Twitter, I had all the connections.
Who are some of the other writers whose work has been meaningful to you?
I mean, Sam Irby would definitely be one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sam Irby and Jenny Lawson's books. Yeah. Of taking anything and making it funny. Early on, I read a lot of Mary Carr and, of course, Jeanette Walls. And then there was that Anthony Bourdain essay. I forgot the name of it, in The New Yorker. It was kind of the first time I'd read something by someone who talked like me.
Yeah.
And doing a job I could recognize. And that was in the fucking New Yorker, which, you know, growing up, it was the only publication I could name. It was National Geographic and The New Yorker. Those were the two magazines that existed, because that's what my grandma had stashed all over her. She was kind of a magazine hoarder. National Geographic's, I actually think, cause hoarding, because they're so stackable. You can build a tower of National Geographic's higher than just about anything else.
This is a brilliant observation, because it is long, like, I've just not even ever looked directly into the reasons why, but I just know that that is just that that is true. I knew that was true. You were saying it. I was like, yes, this is an essential truth. Fuck me. It's because they're squared off. They're squared on the spine. Yes. Yep. New Yorkers don't stack like that.
No, they do not. But Nat Geo's. And you're going to save them because you want to look at those pictures sometime. So, yeah. That is how hoarding starts. Sorry. National Geographic's never going to hire me to write something now.
Well, you never know. You know, you could they could have a resurgence because of you. You never know. Are you one of those writers who walks around with a notebook? Do you hoard words? Do you hoard turns of phrase that are memorable? You know, do you have like what do they call it? A commonplace book?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much that. I keep them, annoyingly enough, in Twitter drafts folder. But like as I'm driving around, I'll think of something, especially if I'm trying to work on something. I wrote that essay about basically being a lesbian in the 90s. And I drove through Texas listening to Sarah McLachlan and the Indigo Girls and all that music. I drove from Albuquerque, New Mexico to Austin just with the iPod listening to all of the 90s music. Garbage was on there, everything.
Yeah.
It was great. And yeah, just as I was driving, I'd talk into the phone and write, and it was a Twitter drafts folder, was just full of basically the entire essay. I don't know why I used that versus notes or something that might have been useful or might have not accidentally sent, but that is what I used. So yeah, I write things down. If I write something on paper, I'll lose it. I put everything in my phone. So I have notebooks, but and they'll have random things in them, especially while I'm editing, I'll write. If I take something out of a piece, I'll write it in a notebook. But they're also full of, like, call the dentist and you need to get your windshield fixed.
That's important, too.
It is.
I'm wondering if there is... I want to know your thoughts on distance, because you just mentioned being a lesbian in the 90s, which really brought me back to a terrifying place. Thank you very much. Sorry. But, you know, that's it's all good. I'm just busting your chops. But, you know, as far as... As personal essay goes and distance, is there, you know, if you were teaching a class, you know, and somebody and a student asked you about that, like, you know, how do you get perspective on things that actually happened to you? Like, is it just a matter of time?
I think it's a matter of time. Maybe mushrooms. they don't hurt. They might hurt. Look, don't take my writing advice if you're a kid listening to this. I'm not your fucking parent. but yeah, time. It's kind of the pandemic question is, I don't want to fucking read your personal essay about the pandemic. I don't think any of us process this.
No.
And it takes a long time to process things. I was writing about an argument I had with, I called her Rhonda in the book. Was it 20 years have passed, 15 years, something like that?
Yeah.
And I realized I was wrong. Like, I was the asshole in that argument. And oops. But yeah, it takes a long time to process when you get past the emotion of it, when you get past the anger of it. And then you have to bring the emotion back to write it. But
yeah,
you have to stop thinking about it in the reactionary emotion. Or I don't know. I don't know what you can write about anything that happened last week. I mean, good for you if you can, but I don't believe you.
The only thing I can do is straight up newspaper reporting. Like at the planning board meeting, they approved of, you know, variance for, you know, XYZ. That's about the extent of it. Just the facts, I think. So, okay, we've done the thing, you and I, and I'm and I'm grateful to you. I just want to ask, is there anything else? we already know what you don't want listeners to take away from this, but is there anything else you want our listeners to know about this book?
Please buy it. I'm terrible at jobs. I will clearly never show up on time. tell your friends to buy it. I can get a bar job. That's about it. Probably don't come tell me your life story. I'm not your therapist.
Can I have your permission to ask you one more question?
Please.
What would your ideal writer's life be next 2-3 years? You know, like what would you wish for?
I don't know. I just want time to write.
Just time to write.
Yeah. I need to get back to Austin. I need to live in a shitty little studio apartment and walk down to a coffee shop and write.
Yeah. Time enough at last, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So.
It's probably not a great answer.
Honestly, it's been a great conversation and I'm grateful for it.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Lauren, for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Thank you so much.
That was Lauren Huff, author of Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing, out now from Vintage Books. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks in books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews.
This message is brought to you by Joseph Rausch, author of Teach Me How to Die. Walter Klein is a depressed widower who has been diagnosed with cancer and has refused treatment. He has no hope for recovery and can't stop thinking about death. When Walter finally does pass, he has no idea what awaits him. The first person Walter meets on his journey is his guide, Vincent. As the two men make their way through different planes of existence and contemplate the true meanings of life and death, something surprising happens. Vincent begins to see Walter as a friend. The adventures that await the lonely spirit and his steadfast guide will change both of their hearts and reveal the truth about human nature. Our reviewer said Joseph Rausch, quote, has a talent for the seamless integration of serious philosophical themes and bantering humor, end quote. Our reviewer calls Teach Me How to Die, quote, a richly creative meditation on love, mortality, and the possibility of what lies beyond, end quote. Teach Me How to Die is available now in paperback and ebook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookshop.org. This message is brought to you by John Russell, author of Riding with Ghosts, Angels, and the Spirits of the Dead. In his memoir, Russell offers stories and insights from his experiences as a fun-loving, motorcycle-riding psychic medium. His account of these brushes with the beyond range from the uncanny to the heartwarming. And according to Russell, they've given him unique insight into the world of the supernatural. Our reviewer called it, quote, an accessible page-turner, written in a lively but matter-of-fact tone, end quote. Illusionist, magician, television personality, and self-proclaimed psychic Uri Geller called Russell's memoir, quote, an incredible supernatural journey that will mesmerize your soul, end quote. Riding with Ghosts, Angels, and the Spirits of the Dead is available now in paperback and ebook on Amazon.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks in books for the week. We have Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon, fiction editor Lori Muchnick, and editorial assistant Johanna Zwerner. Nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau is out of the office this week. Starting with Vicki, what have you chosen for us?
I have a picture book called Hear My Voice, or Escucha Mi Voz, and it is first-person testimony from children who have been detained at the southern border. It's compiled by Warren Binford for Project Amplify, and it's illustrated by a variety of Latinx illustrators who are either active in the United States or in Mexico, or both, or I shouldn't say we're in Mexico or in South America, or both. And it is harrowing, absolutely harrowing. Folks may recall that a couple of years ago, one of my absolute favorite books was a YA book called The Other Side by Juan Pablo Villalobos and translated by Rosalind Harvey. That was for teens what this book is for younger kids. And it just, in their own words, kids who've been trying to make this crossing and who have been detained are just telling you what it's like, both beforehand. One child says, I left Honduras with my father because Honduras is a dangerous place to live. There were people who wanted to hurt us. There were people who had eyes on me whenever I went to school. Our grandfather saw the gang kill our neighbor. They threatened to kill him, and so we all had to leave. And there's this very scary picture of a tiny members of a family moving away from a village and a sort of horrible grasping monster reaching over toward them. Really scary. Another one has pictures of a picture of kids in one of those very famous cages. And the narration says, "Everyone can see me when I am using the toilets. At times I feel so embarrassed because there are boys watching me. My sister and I hold a blanket up for one another so no one can see us when we go to the bathroom. I have been wearing the same clothes for days. I have been here without bathing for 21 days. I wish I could get clean." So the details are ones that kids are absolutely going to resonate with. And it's a book that adults need to be ready to read with their kids. It's not something you just want to grab off the shelf and open up and start reading. You want to know that you're ready to answer all the questions that it's going to bring up. So it's in both English and Spanish. If you flip it over, it's in whatever language you didn't read from the beginning on the other side. And it is just a tremendous sort of document of the pain that these kids are going through and how very badly the United States has been managing this particular sort of migrant movement.
Vicky, I loved this book. It ripped my heart out. And I was also going to compare it to The Other Side, which was a favorite of mine. And one thing I appreciated, so The Other Side was translated by Rosalind Harvey, so it was only in English. But this one, it was a work of multiple translators because they were the kids' first languages. You know, there's a range. I know they listed somewhere Spanish as well as indigenous languages. And I feel like all the different artistic contributors really enhanced it as well, because you get all those different styles that are going to resonate with readers differently. And it's just, yeah, it's an unforgettable book.
Vicky's pick for the week is Hear My Voice, Escucha Mi Voz, edited by Warren Binford. Thank you very much, Vicky, for that choice. Next, we'll have Laura's pick. Laura, what have you chosen for us?
I've got Notes from a Young Black Chef. It's by Kwame Onwuachi with Joshua David Stein. And it's an adaptation of his 2019 memoir for adults. And possibly if you're outside like the restaurant scene, Onwuachi might be most well known because he was a big personality on Top Chef. But in the restaurant world, he's known just for being this young high flyer. I think he's only 31 now. He had Kith and Kin in DC, which unfortunately was, you know, fell victim to the pandemic. But he's just been on this incredible upward trajectory. And it's so interesting to find out about his life story, because even if you're not like a foodie, you know, it's just this story of overcoming many challenges through ingenuity and persistence. He was growing up in the Bronx, and his mother was worried he was heading down, you know, a bad path. So she sent him to live with family in Nigeria. He came back and he ended up still on a bad path for a while. You know, he was selling drugs. He was also selling candy on the subway, and that's how he earned money to start his first catering business. And so he talks very honestly in a way I think young readers will respect about how it is about hard work and persistence, but you also do face real biases, especially in the restaurant industry. He talks about societal racism and industry racism and challenges he's faced there. And I think even for adult readers who might want, you know, a kind of slimmed down version, it would be a great book. A great read-alike would be Marcus Samuelson. He's the Ethiopian Swedish chef who has Red Rooster in Harlem. And he wrote Yes, Chef is his memoir. I'm waiting for that to be adapted for YA. I hope someone will do that. But, you know, teen readers could enjoy that as well, because it also, you know, they both deal with the industry as well as, you know, society at large. So very captivating story.
Hey, Laura, you don't have to wait. It was adapted for young readers in 2015, the Marcus Samuelson memoir. It's called Make It Messy, My Perfectly Imperfect Life.
Oh.
And the adaptation was done with Veronica Chambers, who's done a lot of great work, both in her own right and also sort of working to make material that was originally published for adults, sort of making it, shaping it for younger readers. So put it on reserve at the library. It's ready for you.
Yay. Excellent. Thank you. It's not often that I say I wish for something and that it already happens. So.
If only great. I could do this every day.
Laura's pick for the week is Notes from a Young Black Chef by Kwame Onwuachi with Joshua David Stein. Thank you very much, Laura, for that pick. Next, we have fiction with Lori. Lori, what have you chosen for us?
I've got a book called Good Company by Cynthia Dupree Sweeney, who you might remember from her first novel, The Nest, which came out a few years
ago.
It was really fun. This novel is, you know, similar in that it's about sort of a group of people and their relationships and things that happen in their lives. It's not tons of plot. It's more, you know, interpersonal based. It's about two couples, Flora and Julian and Margot and David. Well, three of them are actors and David is a surgeon. And the two couples are really good friends. And, you know, when they're young, they live in New York and they're Margot and Flora are trying to get parts. They work on Broadway. They do Shakespeare in the Park. Margot meets David. When he comes up, someone has a heart attack while she's performing Shakespeare in the Park, and she does the classic, you know, is there a doctor in the house? And there he is. So they go back, you know, years and years. They spend a lot of their summers up on another friend's property, upstate New York, where they do a special summer theater extravaganza every summer. So that's in the past of the book. In the present, Flora and Julian's 18-year-old daughter, Ruby, is just about to graduate from high school. And while Flora is looking for a photo that she wants of the five of them, the two couples and Ruby, that she wants to put in a frame to give Ruby as a present, she finds at the back of a file cabinet Julian's original wedding ring, which he claimed to have lost in a pond while they were upstate New York years ago. So this precipitates all kinds of, you know, crisis. What happened? You know, Julian had an affair, and what does she want to do? And who was it with? And what, you know, how does this affect both couples and their relationships? It's one thing that I really liked about it. They all now, in the present time of the novel, they all live in LA. Margot's on a big sort of Grey's Anatomy television show. Flora is a voiceover artist. There's a lot about their work, which I always find really interesting. And Sweeney is really good on, you know, distinctions between how they view their jobs and what they actually do all day on their jobs. And that was really fun to read. And, you know, just kind of very, it's not sort of a heavy book, even though it's about important interpersonal things, and it's very charming and lots of delightful stuff going on. So I enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is a book I remember seeing the review for this come in and thinking, oh, I really want to read this. Also because it reminds me of this book, The Body Politic by Brian Platzer. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that analyzing of a marriage and an affair, and also like the way couples interact and the way friends interact and sort of love and marriage in the context of a group of friends is very similar to me to some of the themes of The Body Politic. Also just thinking about, you know, dreams and dreams of acting and how those dreams change and how they change when kids are involved. And I think those dynamics I've always found to be really interesting, and kind of falling in and out of love, both with your partner and with your friends and also with your work. And I'm always excited to read books that talk about, you know, what people are doing all day. I think it's easy to sometimes, you know, sort of disregard that. And it's always interesting when it's discussed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lori's pick for the week is Good Company by Cynthia Dupree Sweeney. Thank you very much for that choice. Finally, last but not least, we have a wild card pick from Johanna. Johanna, what have you chosen for us?
Yeah, my pick is Antonio. It's by Beatrice Bracker. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right.
Sounds good.
It's translated by Adam Morris. And it's a really beautiful book about a Brazilian family, the entire family's lineage. It's told through the eyes of several characters. And it's sort of this one young man's attempt to piece together the history, not only of his parents, but kind of his family and his family's friends. And there are really interesting moments. It can be self-referential in a really lovely way. The main character's name is Benjamin, and his grandmother, Isabel, says to him, "This isn't a beautifully intricate novel in which your mother is the hero and I'm the character who picks up the pieces of her broken love. No, Benjamin, the story of our lives still isn't finished and it never will be." So there's definitely moments like that where you can kind of see there's a little bit of play between, you know, the writer and the reader. But it's also, I found it really interesting because I feel like I almost never read books primarily in the second person. And this one is almost exclusively in the second person. It's sort of revealed to Benjamin the history of his parents and how they met and their friendships through them and through their friends. So each chapter is narrated by a different friend of the family or a different member of his family. There's lots of structural mirroring. There's the mirroring of a friendship that happens between Benjamin's grandfather and one of his friends, and then his father, Teodoro, and one of his friends. And Benjamin himself is actually, it's sort of fascinating. He's a bit of a cipher because he's sort of just learning through these characters. We don't know a ton about him. We know that he's expecting his own first child. So he's kind of going on this journey of discovery about his father. And I mean, I think, you know, it's very much fathers and sons. It's also talking about mental illness. You know, the mental illness in his family has kind of traced through the line from his grandfather to his father. So you're a little bit thinking like, you know, where is he himself at? But you're learning a lot about his father, especially. And I mean, I think it's just, you know, it's really a powerful exploration of inherited trauma. It's framed by his grandmother's sickness. She's right now in the hospital, this grandmother, Isabel. She's got cancer, but you see her having devoted so much of her life to Javier, her husband, even when he kind of went mad. And then later to Teodoro, who has kind of lived many lives and has also sort of unraveled. And I think at the end, it becomes a bit of a celebration of all of the sacrifices that the women in this family have made for these very sort of difficult, but obviously charismatic, but very temperamental men. And I don't know, I found it to be a super, super touching kind of history of one family.
That sounds good. I love books that are in the second person. You don't get them that often. You know, I guess there's Bright Lights, Big City, and I know there have been books since then. I'm not thinking of any offhand, but I always enjoy unusual narrative voices.
Yeah, it was actually so nice. I was trying to think about the last time. I think sometimes in maybe some of Javier Marias' books, it has happened. But I felt like I hadn't read a book written that way in ages, and it was really, really deftly done. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm really excited to read my galley of this after we get off. But before we do, Johanna's pick for the week is Antonio by Beatriz Bracker, translated by Adam Morris. Thank you very much, Johanna, for that pick.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you all so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Hanif Abdurraqib, author of A Little Devil in America. Everybody loves this book, and I am so excited to speak with him then. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.